Today is Tuesday, the 17th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What is Kabul like a day after the Taliban take control?
The Taliban on the street so far seem to be sticking to the orders from their senior leadership, which is we haven't heard reports of violence around the city. That said, a lot of people are still anxious.
Plus, U.S. President Joe Biden responds to the criticism on how his administration handled the situation.
Our mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to have been nation building.
Our expanded coverage begins now. A day after Taliban fighters took up positions in Kabul, the Afghan capital's international airport on Monday was frenetic with thousands of Afghans looking for a way out, U.S. soldiers firing warning shots as they sought to keep the area secure, and Western nations arranging the evacuation of their nationals and some of the local staff who worked for and aided them since the start of the war 20 years ago. At least five people were reported being killed in the chaos. VOA Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau Chief Aisha Tanzim is in Kabul and with us for the latest.
A lot of Taliban on the streets of Kabul. Their presence significantly increased by late afternoon. They are now on almost every street of Kabul. All the police checkpoints that used to be manned by police are now being manned by Taliban. They seem to have taken over all the function that police or security forces were performing beforehand. So we saw Taliban outside the house of Abdullah Abdullah. We saw Taliban outside the compound that led to the U.S. embassy. We saw them driving around town. All of them, by the way, armed with Kalashnikovs, usually dangling to one side as they drove around on their motorcycles or rode on their security vehicles or just walked around on foot.
So what did you see while walking around?
Interesting scenes that we witnessed today at, their body language was not hostile. They were at checkpoints asking drivers, bending down, but sometimes at least some of them with a smile and sometimes with a hand raised to their chest, which is a gesture of respect locally. In one street, we saw two Taliban get out of their vehicle to help break up a fight over a fender bender.
Aisha, the Taliban originally were not going to go into the city, but then did so when they heard, at least according to the Taliban, that police and other security forces were abandoning their posts and they entered to kind of maintain order, according to them. What can you tell us about, like, say, some of the situations in the city itself?
There was no looting, but the city was also completely shut down. No shops were open, no offices were open, no banks, nothing. So the traffic, which Kabul is famous for, horrible traffic jams during rush hour, was very light compared to normal, except if you went toward the airport. The situation around the airport was quite bad.
Actually, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about what's going on at the airport, because there have been pictures of those thousands of people lining up trying to get flights out. In terms of the evacuation process for those who are wanting to leave the country, you know, what can you share with our listeners as to the difficulties in terms of people trying to get out?
Well, there are a lot of difficulties, and foreigners are facing difficulties, but locals who want to get out are facing even more difficulties. It starts with many Afghans not having passports, or they have passports. I know a bunch of people who had passports because they used to travel, but their kids don't have passports. And the passport office had huge lines for the last several months. Thousands of people applied at the same time when it became clear that Taliban were making battlefield advances around the country. Then even those who have passports have no visas. Because of COVID, there are a lot of restrictions, and getting visas is difficult these days, especially when you hold an Afghan passport on which you need a visa to get to anywhere. And now, because of the Taliban entering the city, a lot of embassies are closed. So there is no hope of getting a visa. And if you had all of that, you had passport, you had visa, tickets outside of Kabul, as soon as Taliban got closer and the provincial capital started falling, tickets out of Kabul skyrocketed. A ticket that used to cost $150 one way was costing $750. So affording the tickets, especially if you were a family of a couple of people, not just one, became difficult. And land routes were not safe because Taliban were making advances all around the country and they were controlling the border crossings. So that became a problem. And then if you have all of that, you have a passport, visa, ticket, getting into the airport. The security situation around the airport is crazy right now with thousands of people. And as you said, the people who could get inside, most civilian flights were canceled in the last few days. So you have hundreds of people just camping out on the tarmac. And you see these social media videos of a flight landed and people just rushed towards it and climbed it, not just on the inside, but on the outside, just trying to get somehow inside. It looked like a scene from a movie. It was surreal.
Aisha, one last question. What can you tell us about how people are reacting to the Taliban being in the city now? Because there was lots of concern about potential bloodshed and potential strife once they got in.
Well, the Taliban on the street so far seem to be sticking to the orders from their senior leadership, which is we haven't heard reports of violence around the city. That said, a lot of people are still anxious and waiting and watching, and they're not 100% certain that they will continue to stick by the orders. So a lot of minorities, Hazaras, etc., I spoke to, they were anxious and trying to get out. Activists are anxious and trying to get out. Women activists in particular are anxious. Local journalists who filed reports over the years of Taliban violation of human rights or criticize the Taliban in some way are anxious. Some people are just planning to stay home till they get a better handle of what the situation will be like and how Taliban will react to things. A lot of people are just waiting and watching with bated breath.
Aisha Tanzim is VOA's Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau Chief, and she was speaking to me from Kabul, Afghanistan. U.S. President Joe Biden addressed the nation about the situation in Afghanistan Monday. Biden said that the reason for entering the country was to bring justice to those who attacked the United States on September 11th, 2001.
We never gave up the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and we got him. That was a decade ago. Our mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to have been nation building. It was never supposed to be creating a unified, centralized democracy.
The president said that he and his administration were clear-eyed about the risks and that the Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country and that its military collapsed, sometimes without trying to fight.
If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
Biden remarked that what's currently happening now in Afghanistan could have happened 5 years ago or 15 years in the future. But as the United States continues its withdrawal, the Taliban attack or disrupted the process, American forces would respond swiftly.
We would defend our people with devastating force if necessary.
After the president's address, I spoke with Anthony Cordesman, the Burke Chair in Strategy at the Centers for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, about the president's remarks.
I think he made a strong case that no matter how long we stayed, we couldn't achieve the objective of somehow creating an effective government and democracy, and that there was no time we could predict that Afghan forces would be capable of defending themselves. He also made, I think, a valid case that terrorism is not centered now in Al-Qaeda or Afghanistan, that we do face a very wide mix of potential terrorist threats that can go from the countries and areas they're operating in and carry out attacks on the United States, that we have to be able to respond from the outside on a global basis. He spoke firmly about American resolution and willingness to use devastating amounts of force. And in all those areas, I think he made a good case. He also did not take a partisan tone. He did not dwell on the fact that it was in many ways President Trump that started this process and catalyzed it by setting deadlines for U.S. withdrawal.
So what about some areas where perhaps the president didn't hit the mark?
To say the Afghan forces wouldn't fight ignores the fact that their ability to fight was dependent on U.S. air power, on U.S. support from train and assist forces, on massive amounts of contractors that were funded and supported by the U.S., and on U.S. intelligence. They were never equipped with the right equipment. It was far too sophisticated. They couldn't operate it on their own as the U.S. withdrew. They couldn't keep the bases and intelligence capability functioning. And indeed, in many areas, the U.S. effectively destroyed those bases. He referred to 300,000 troops. Well, there aren't even approximately 300,000 troops. 60% of that number consists of the Afghan National Police, which are corrupt, ineffective, and have never been trained to be combat force. He also did not state the extent to which their support and funding was dependent on U.S. management simply to ensure that they would get food, supplies, and ammunition. And our withdrawal certainly in many ways crippled them. He altered his approach to the issue of nation building. Initially, he has said that we weren't there for nation building. In this speech, and this was an important change, he said that we could not continue with a failed nation-building effort. I think that was a more honest approach, but it did involve a change in his previous perspective. He was also honest in referring to the fact that there were many missteps, and he was certainly correct in saying that one of the things that was truly bipartisan over 20 years was that every administration involved made missteps. And some of them were important.
That was the Center for Strategic and International Studies Burke Chair in Strategies, Anthony Cordesman. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A day after the Afghan capital fell to the Taliban without a fight, U.S. and other foreign forces continue to protect and hold Kabul's international airport, where panicked crowds have fled to seek refuge from the Taliban. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has this update on what's taking place on the ground.
The situation on the ground right now is chaotic. The only way that I can describe it is simply chaotic. I've been told by officials, John Kirby actually just reiterated that there would be about 3,500 U.S. troops on the ground by the end of the day. And then we should see the other ones coming in the following hours to potentially days. What we've seen at the airport is just heartbreaking. We have seen Afghan civilians fleeing and flooding the tarmacs where the aircraft are, trying to get on these airplanes so the Taliban cannot attack them. And it has been so severe that it stopped all air traffic. The U.S. for several hours has stopped air traffic control. I've been told by my sources that one flight was just able to come in with some more Marines, but that basically means that none of the troops that are supposed to be securing the airport are able to get in and secure the airport. And then also none of the evacuees are able to get out. So it's a really tense situation at this moment. I've seen a picture with more than 600 evacuees on a C-17. Usually they were telling us, officials were saying that about 300 people could be on a C-17 pretty comfortably. So you can just imagine having twice as many as expected being on an aircraft trying to be evacuated. And this is not something that's going to be solved in the coming minutes or hours. This is something that is going to take days. There are thousands that need to be evacuated. And right now we're talking about hundreds that have been evacuated.
Speaking of evacuations, Carla, I wanted to ask you about this footage that's making its rounds throughout the internet, and it's pretty horrific footage. It appears to be showing, it does show an object falling from one of these planes leaving the Kabul airport, and some are saying that it is a person, which we have not been able to independently verify. Did John Kirby, the spokesperson for the Pentagon, address that?
The entire world has been watching is this horrific footage. And we've heard reports that there have been civilians that were crushed by this military plane. I am being told by a U.S. official on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak to the press, but I'm being told that there is an investigation underway about these deaths. They're looking into it. And that is a big reason why the airspace at the airport was completely shut down, because they did not want to have any more flights that could potentially be swarmed by Afghan civilians and that could end up resulting in casualties. Very horrific footage to see. It's heartbreaking to see how desperate some of these Afghans are to get out of the country. And we can only hope that the U.S. military and the U.S. government get everything together to start evacuating more of these people as soon as possible.
Thank you very much for that information, Carla. I was wondering if the Pentagon has responded to any kind of questions as to what it was doing in the region leading up to the Taliban takeover of the country. The Pentagon and defense individuals were always mentioning that they could carry out over-the-horizon attacks in support of the Afghan military, and if there were issues on the ground that were threatening U.S. forces or U.S. interests.
Well, one of the frustrating things that reporters here have been noticing is the lack of U.S. involvement as Afghanistan fell over the weekend. It had been several days since the U.S. carried out an airstrike. I asked about that specifically. I said to the Pentagon press secretary, I said, what was going on? Why was the Afghan Air Force conducting more strikes than the huge U.S. Air Force? And he said that while the U.S. had the capabilities, they were conducting strikes when it was feasible, which makes you wonder, how is the U.S. going to carry out its counter-terror fight in Afghanistan? How feasible is that going to be if they were deeming it not very feasible to conduct strikes against a massing Taliban insurgency that was coming in around the country? So that will be interesting to see in the coming days and weeks and months how the U.S. counter-terror war is going to follow through, or how the U.S. is going to follow through with the counter-terror war. But the primary focus right now is getting the Afghan allies, the Americans that are left in Afghanistan, getting them out of the country. And so you can clearly see that the Pentagon is laser focused on that right now.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Heavy criticism continued to be leveled at U.S. President Joe Biden and his administration on Monday over the rapid fall of the Afghan government under Ashraf Ghani. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on what senators and representatives are saying.
That's right. As one might expect, congressional Republicans have been swift to condemn President Joe Biden for this decision to withdraw U.S. troops and for, frankly, what they are saying is being taken aback or taken by surprise by how swiftly the Taliban took over major Afghan cities and, of course, moved into Kabul and took it over really without any fight from Afghan troops. They're saying that this is a failure of U.S. intelligence, a failure of leadership from the Biden White House, and that it could potentially damage U.S. credibility worldwide in a way that we really haven't seen since the fall of Saigon during the Vietnam War you know, almost 50 years ago, which frankly is something that really lingers in the American psyche as a failure of American leadership. They're saying that these really intense images of Afghans cleaning the U.S. cargo planes as they leave the Kabul airport are going to linger in the memory for a very long time. And some answers really need to be found out about how all of this went down.
Catherine, comments from Republicans are to be expected. But the Biden administration is also receiving a lot of criticism from Democrats, his own party. What can you tell us about what those members are saying?
That's right. You know, this is one of those difficult situations where some Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who said that he is to be commended for his leadership and for taking the difficult decision of finally ending this nearly two-decade U.S. conflict in the region. She's saying, look, the president was put in a very difficult position that past U.S. presidents have struggled with this issue as well, and he's made the move to protect U.S. personnel in the country, to protect those Afghan allies, and he should be commended for it. But on the other side, remember, you also have some Democrats who served in Afghanistan, who served in Iraq, who really know what the situation is like on the ground. And they're saying that the U.S. did not properly plan for this. We didn't seem to have a good exit strategy for protecting the U.S. embassy and getting our people out of there. And of course, a discussion that's been bubbling up in Washington over the past few weeks and months is why we have not expedited the visa process for those Afghan interpreters, those people who really helped the U.S. and their allies and put themselves and their families at risk to help the U.S. effort there. And we haven't made sure that they are safe and that they are protected from near certain reprisal on the part of the Taliban, torture, death. They will face that if the U.S. does not somehow step up this process and get them out.
One last question. Some have described what took place in Afghanistan as a failure of intelligence, a failure of planning. Have you heard anything about potential investigations or hearings within the halls of Congress?
That's right. Well, even though the U.S. Congress is not in session right now, it seems to have a knack for not being in session at these big moments. And of course, we're deep in the middle of an August recess, but we're already hearing from some Republicans that they might want to call members back to Washington because of the serious nature of this event and what we're seeing from Kabul, these intense pictures. They're saying that they want to bring people back for an investigation, for possible hearings, to look at the process and really understand the planning that went into this on the part of the Biden White House and whether they were adequately prepared for an event of this magnitude and why there were so many security failures and why those Afghan interpreters were not receiving their visas in a quicker manner.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international group of scientists led by American and Canadian researchers have written a unique study that provides a detailed look at the entire life of a 17,000-year-old Arctic woolly mammoth. The researchers say in a press release that they produced and examined isotopic information from the mammoth's tusk in a fossil provided by the University of Alaska Museum of the North. Isotopes are chemical elements whose atomic structure had been modified in some way from their native configuration. The researchers say they were able to use this data to match the mammoth's movements and diet with isotopic maps of their home region. While the scientists don't know if the mammoth migrated with the seasons, they were able to ascertain that it traveled a distance equal to circling the Earth twice. Their findings are detailed in the journal Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The death toll from Saturday's earthquake in Haiti has reached nearly 1,300 as the country's medical professionals struggle to save the lives of those who have been injured in the natural disaster. Jean Handy-Tiebert now joins us from Lakai, Haiti.
The situation on the southwestern part of Haiti, especially in the city of Lakai, is pretty complicated. Complicated because Lakai was already cut from the capital of Haiti, from Port-au-Prince, because of gang violence. So to go to Lakai from Port-au-Prince, you need to cross the town of Martissant. And right now, there's a very powerful gang that control Martissant, which means For a long time, for about like 2 months, a lot of supplies were missing in Lekai because food trucks and other stuff could not get to Lekai. So the earthquake could not happen at a worse time than now. Right now, the people are missing water. The people are missing food supply and medication. So the earthquake happened in a time that nobody expected it because we were hit by an earthquake 10 years ago. So we thought it would take longer for Haiti to be hit by another earthquake again. So when the earthquake happened on Saturday morning, it was pretty shock for everybody. And then a lot of casualties happened in Lekai. A lot of people died over there, and a lot of people are still missing.
Handy, what can you tell us about those rescue efforts?
The rescue effort was very, very, very slow because of the situation in the neighborhood of Martinsville. Because when it happened, everything is centralized in Port-au-Prince. When the earthquake happened, we could not, the government and even anybody who want to assist could not cross the city of Martinsville easily to come to Lekai to help and to provide medical supply and everything that they need. So it took a long time. It took a long time for the people of Lekai to see help get here because the government had to negotiate somehow and try to have a peace treaty with the gang members to open the road of Martinsville. This is very important because that played a key role in having the death toll going up so quickly because a lot of people were under the rubble and expecting to be rescued. But unfortunately, it took too long for help to get to Lekai to help them.
The government has now entered a recovery phase, sometimes taking demolition experts to kind of look through the rubble to find additional people. Have the government authorities given any inclination as to what they think the final casualty count may be?
No, definitely. But we are expecting it to go higher. Because not only the city of Lekai is the biggest city in the south, in the southwest of Haiti. But around Lekai, there is a lot of small towns, and they were hit pretty badly. I can name a town called Cavaillon. I stopped at Cavaillon when I was coming here, and it's pretty bad. Cavaillon is worse than Lekai. You know, it's a small town, and almost all the buildings, at least two-story buildings, have collapsed, and they don't have anything to help them look for people, or even they didn't start the demolition there yet. So I expect the death toll to go higher, and because of these small towns around Lekai, and over there they have less supply, they have less equipment, they have less, you know, less hope to find any survival at this time.
Handy, in the time that we have left, can you kind of speak to the challenges in getting aid and supplies to these affected areas to help those that are in need?
The government started to receive aid from a lot of countries, like Chile. The Chilean government sent a very big plane to Haiti this morning. They are organizing the dispatch and distribution of this aid, these medical supplies, you know, food, like food ready to eat, like MREs, food that doesn't need to be cooked, stuff like that. So, and then medical supply, you know, for the hospitals, for the people that were injured. So pretty much they are organizing, they're still organizing. There's a government entity called the Civil Protection in Port-au-Prince that is organizing all the aid that they've been receiving. Starting today, from USAID, from Chile, from Venezuela, from Cuba, from Mexico, and the Dominican Republic, all these countries, they started to send stuff in Haiti. But as I'm telling you, everything is coming to Port-au-Prince. Everything is coming to Port-au-Prince. Then they have to organize it, maybe find a way to bring it here by air or by land, if the gangs of Martinsville allow that to happen.
Reporting from Lekai, Haiti, that's Gene Handy Tiebert. And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news. You can do so 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.